You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
Today we're going to talk about emerging market equities, and I'm speaking to Varun Lijawala, portfolio manager at 91 in London, and we're going to talk about why he thinks, and 91 thinks, that active EM equities as a strategy is maybe better than having a passive approach to emerging market equities via a passive fund or an exchange-traded fund. Varun, great to speak to you again after all these years. The first thing you say is governance is the key. Now, governance is a big, big subject. Why do you highlight that, first of all?
Hi, Lindsay. Yeah, good to speak again. Thanks for your time. I suppose if you sort of distill down the active versus passive debate, there's many avenues you can probably go down. The obvious one is obviously alpha, which is why you pay an active manager fees. But I think beyond alpha, which is obviously a qualifying factor, the reason you want to go active over passive is really governance. And what I mean by governance is, think about what you get when you go passive in emerging markets. An ETF will typically give you 1,400 stocks within that one facility. And those 1,400 stocks, you're essentially owning the entire index. So you don't have the ability to really understand the underlying securities in terms of their governance structures, in terms of their board composition, in terms of the related party transactions that may or may not be happening. So I think when you think about sort of emerging markets and the risks that come with emerging markets, going passive means you almost double up on those risks. And I think that that in itself, beyond getting into the alpha conversation, should be sufficient to go down the active route.
And I think when you say 1,400 underlying securities with an ETF tracker fund, it doesn't beg a question. It makes an obvious statement that not all emerging market equities are created equal, so you have to be selective.
I think that's right. I mean, when we do our bottom-up work, and we're fortunate to have a deeply resourced, experienced fundamental research team, both based here in London, but also Hong Kong and in South Africa. Now, when we do our bottom-up work, you'll be surprised what we find with some of our companies. So anecdotally, if I give you a case study.
Yes.
So a few years ago, we were looking at a Russian airline. And for an airline, it looked remarkably compelling. So the quality of the business, the cash flow returns on investment versus the cost of capital for an airline were remarkable, very positive. Then we looked at the valuation of the business in relation to the quality, and there was a clear mismatch. There was an anomaly there. This was a very cheap airline that had an unusual level of quality for the industry. And then we sort of got one level deeper and tried to understand sort of the governance norms within this business. And one of the things we look at, Lindsay, is the board structure, but just not just the board structure at a moment in time. We look at the evolution of the board structure and, importantly, the proposals that the founder has put forward in terms of who should be added or removed from the board. And this was one of those sort of let's remember this type moments where we had actually realized that not once, but twice, the founder's two sons, and at the time they were 1 and 2 years old respectively, had been proposed to become board directors. And so when you think about the governance of a business like that, it's clearly uninvestable.
I find it extraordinary that they make that mistake, though, because obviously a diligent asset management company like 91 will surely look into that. They obviously didn't realize that they would be found out.
I think this is the sort of whole point of going active versus passive. There's 1,400 securities, right? So if you go passive, just don't have the bandwidth to sort of go through 1,400 annual reports and 1,400 director proposals. So for a business like that, for us, it's a very obvious no. And then there's the associated risks that come with that. If you propose a two-year-old to the board, think about what's happening with capital allocation there and so on and so forth. So you get this cascading effect once governance has been breached, and it's the governance that we focus on.
Yes, governance is all very well, and 20 years ago, governance wasn't an issue, but now it really is. How difficult is it to apply governance principles when you're investing?
I think it's simple, the principles, but it's not easy in terms of the work it takes to do it properly. And I think there's a perception gap that exists in emerging markets. I think if you speak to the average sort of Joe Schmo, they'll tell you, well, governance is of lower standards in EM than it is DM. I don't think that is necessarily true. I think there's pockets of the market where governance is less than ideal, and it's those pockets that deserves more attention, particularly from an active approach. The question related to this one is really investing in China. And how do we get comfortable with governance in China, but not just governance, the whole piece, the political side, the geopolitical side, and layered on top of that is obviously the regulatory piece. So I suppose, you know, when we look at China, before we do any work on any company across any sector in China, we ask ourselves two questions. The first question is, how does geopolitics affect this business? Mm. How could geopolitics affect this business in China? And if we get comfortable with that question, or rather the answer to that question, we'll then ask the second qualifying question, which is, what social purpose does this business serve in China? And that really is a nod to common prosperity, which has become really a mainstay across Chinese corporates now.
It's an interesting one because you've got my mind racing a little bit, because it's so pertinent when you talk about geopolitics. And it's not your job as a portfolio manager at 91 in London to comment upon politics. But when I see Putin and Xi cozying up quite regularly, is it difficult for you to separate geopolitics from governance?
I think it's part of the day job, Lindsay. I think gone are the days where you can neatly segregate different issues and say, I'll have that one, but I'll leave this one to someone else. I think it's all intertwined. And you think about, ultimately what we're trying to do, we're trying to understand the future cash flows of the business. And as fund managers and analysts, apply an appropriate discount rate to those cash flows. Now, the question you've posed around geopolitics and politics and regulation, all those factors will go into your discount rate. So it's impossible to strip them out. They need to be included in the work. And I think, coming back to those two questions we ask in China, that is part of that work. If you don't ask those two questions, what you could end up buying is companies that are going to be sanctioned. So for example, we have a hard line in that we have never owned and will never own companies in China that, for example, make closed circuit television cameras. We'll never own companies that make dual hardware technology. Because when you think about those types of businesses, that's clearly the use of those products could be for reconnaissance and so forth. Now, that would very obviously be in the crosshairs of the US. So that's sort of where we get to with the type of work we do.
It's interesting, isn't it? So I suppose, given all you've just said about China and governance and geopolitics, the bottom-up approach is particularly important when having a look at potential China investments.
Absolutely. And I think sort of beyond bottom-up, with China, you need to go one step further, which is, it's our belief that you need to have boots on the ground. Because understanding the cultural nuances of investing in China, sitting across the room from a management team and reading body language, because sometimes it's the unspoken that's just as powerful as the spoken. The value of that cannot be overstated. And just again, anecdotally, you think about how different China is in the Western markets. When we have a good day in the markets, an up day, we see green on our Bloomberg screens. Now, in China, when you have an up day, you see red on your screens because red is the lucky color. So it's just a different beast. And having boots on the ground, having people who speak the language, who are there, who travel to and from the markets and kick the tires, I think is immensely useful. And that's our setup here at 91.
You say in the report that you very kindly sent me, you say the team has less money in China today than they have in the previous 8 years. And then you go on to say many long-only asset managers are in the same five stocks. It almost sounds like the US markets where seven stocks dominate. You say five stocks dominate when it comes to long-only managers in China.
Yeah, so I suppose to a certain extent, Lindsay, two separate questions. On the first one, having less money today in China than over the previous 8 years, we tend to sort of swim where the fish are swimming. That's what we're trying to do, go where the opportunities are. And I think it's very obvious, given the sort of backdrop we've discussed, that the opportunities have been elsewhere. Now, we don't take a structural view. We play every ball on its merits. And I think China will have its day in the sun. There have been a few false starts. But I think if you look at what the companies are doing, again, bringing it back to the fundamentals, forget the geopolitics, forget the politics. If you look at what the companies are doing, the companies, there's been a step change in how they allocate capital. And that shows up in the quantum of dividends and in the quantum of buybacks, which have almost trebled over the last 3 years. So the companies have realized that in order for them to generate stakeholder value, they need to allocate capital more thoughtfully. And that's happening. So I think when the sort of exogenous factors start becoming tailwinds or even stop becoming headwinds, then I think the market will focus on fundamentals and China will then be in a very different mind space than it is today. I suppose on your second question, which is the long-only asset managers being in the same five stocks, some of them are Chinese, you're absolutely right. The others are not. So your TSMCs, your Samsung Electronics and your Reliance Industries. This was a question posed to us by a market participant not so long ago. And the question was, why is it that most fund managers own these same five stocks? And I suppose the way I would answer that question is almost from a utilitarian standpoint. And by that, I mean, if you look at sort of the defining characteristic of the emerging market equity asset class, it's not that it gives you structural growth. It's not necessarily that it gives you the access to higher risk premium. It's not even that it gives you potentially the diversification benefits you were hoping for. I think the one mainstay characteristic of the asset class is the cyclicality of it, the volatility of it. And the proof of that is if you line up the various asset classes from top to bottom over the last 20 calendar years, roughly 75% of those calendar years, emerging market equity is either the best performing asset class or the worst performing asset class. So it's a cyclical asset class. So coming back to the question, why do fund managers own the same handful of stocks? It's survivorship bias. These are companies that you know are going to be around tomorrow and the day after and the day after. And having that anchor in the portfolio in inherently a cyclical asset class is probably the way to manage money more prudently.
So in other words, you don't have to worry about the cycles with these companies. I mean, obviously, if the cycle is down, they're going to do badly, but less badly than others, and vice versa. So that is a cyclical management tool, if you like, to be in these strong companies with a history of good management and strong balance sheets. And is that the way you look at it at 91?
I think that's entirely fair, Lindsay. The only sort of consideration I'd make there is coming back to a comment we made earlier, which is we play every ball on its merit. And as behavioral investors, as, you know, our process is all about understanding where behavioral anomalies exist. One of the very obvious behavioral errors that investors make is the endowment effect, which is essentially falling in love with what you own. So what we try to do is understand our companies deeply, but try not to fall in love with them. And the way to do that is, again, to simplify. What are the three key drivers for this company? And if these are the key drivers for long-term stakeholder value, how are they tracking versus expectations? What we want to own are good quality companies that are beating expectations around those KPIs. So long as these businesses are beating expectations, Lindsay, they'll be in our portfolio. But if that changes, then our minds will change.
We're going on a geographical tour. We started with Russia, then we went to China, and now we've got to go to India. And again, actually, I don't want to bring up geopolitics this time, but the three countries that I've just mentioned are all suddenly a little bit closer than maybe they would have been when you first started investing in emerging market equities. Are there opportunities in India? As the world's most populous country, there must be an enormous amount of opportunity.
I think the short answer is yes. And sort of the proof of the pudding is in the eating. If I look at our portfolio, we have more money in India today than we've had in the last 8 years. So yes, absolutely. We've been finding opportunities. I should qualify by saying that what we've discussed today are probably two of the most consensus trades in emerging markets. And we're always mindful of consensus trades. The obvious first consensus trade is being negative on China. The other side of that equation is being very positive on India. So I suppose to make money from here on in with regard to these two markets, India as a market has never been more expensive than China. China as a market has never been cheaper than India. So I suppose where I'm going, Lindsay, is that the easy money around asset allocation, being overweight one and underweight the other, that easy money has been made. And I think that links back nicely to where we started this conversation around active and passive. Remember, passive can only go market weight. And I think really to make money now in these two biggest markets, remember, India is almost 20% of the index. China is roughly 26% of the index. So these two markets alone account for almost half of the benchmark. To make money in these two markets now, given where valuations are versus each other, it's all about stock selection. It's all about the stock picking, coming back to the active side of things. So what we've been doing over the last 2 years is spending an inordinate amount of time in India, kicking the tires in Mumbai, in Delhi, in Gurgaon, in Bangalore, really touring the tier one, tier two, and even tier three cities, trying to look for phenomenal businesses that are, you know, beating their expectations. And we found a number of them across a range of sectors. I'll throw in a few names here.
Yes, please.
You know, when you think about healthcare hospitals are incredibly fragmented. And we have invested in a wonderful business called Max Healthcare, which are predominantly in the north of India. And what they're doing is consolidating a very fragmented market with top-notch healthcare. And really, the KPI for this business is to ensure that customers get served on time. And so the incredible thing is, if you call their 24-hour call center and you need access to healthcare, if the call center doesn't pick up in four rings, the call gets automatically diverted to the operations manager in the region.
That's extraordinary.
Now, if that operations manager doesn't pick up in four rings, the call gets diverted automatically to the founder of this business, the managing director and CEO. So you can imagine, you know, this gentleman getting a call in the middle of the night. He's he's not going to be happy with his call center or his operations director. So they are absolutely on it. It's a wonderful business. And we found a handful of businesses in India that have that sort of ethos around serving the customer.
It's very interesting that you have a look at a company's worth because of its customer care. Obviously, there are many other metrics that you look at, but that is a very interesting approach. Varun, a fascinating insight into those three countries and your philosophy at 91. Varun Lajawala is a portfolio manager at 91 in London. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.